to OS News Podcast, episode number 25, for September 27th, 2009. We missed last week. Unfortunately, that was just an instance of Tom wasn't here, nor was Tess, nor was anybody else. And so me, Croc, just thought it would be a bit of a rubbish show, just me alone. So we skipped that, and now we've got 2 weeks' worth of news to catch up on.
Yeah, so at least we've got enough to talk about this time.
Absolutely, yes. And it's been pretty good. Of course, we've been waiting for how many years for the Haiku release?
8 years. I don't know the amount of days, but in any case, 8 years.
Well, it's not really, sorry, I should correct you, I should say. Well, it's an alpha. It is their first official release of sorts, isn't it? Even though it's alpha, of course, and they're being very clear in that, but it is the first, you know, signed, sealed, and delivered. Release. Actually, just before we get on to that, feedback from the previous show, episode 24, we had a couple of comments in the thread on the website. Again, nothing we can cover, I think.
There's more some general comments.
There's one, yeah, there were general things. Thank you, of course, for everybody. One last thing I wanted to say, actually, about that was... the complaints about GCC, my complaints about GCC, and I was saying that RMS was being a hurdle to Apple getting changes done to GCC and how they wanted. I think I was partly right and partly mistaken there, because I unfortunately don't remember where. I have this habit of being able to remember news items from like 5 or 6 years ago, but can't find where they actually are on the internet. It was, I saw a video, and it was either from an Apple developer conference or it was from a Google talk or something like that by the Clang developers, which were talking about, or the OLVM and Clang developers, which were talking about the history of the project. And I think it was actually some of the developers from Apple themselves that were talking about the history of the project, and that's where I got the information about how Richard Stallman was being a hurdle to them. They may be... And I think I was defending the point a little bit too much there. So apologies for that, because I can't remember the exact words and I can't find them on the internet either. So that was my mistake.
Okay.
Other than that, we had an email. It's from Nicola Wernick. But unfortunately, it's a bit too long for us to be able to read on the show. But it was just generalizing about the show, about app stores, about Linux, everything we covered. So thank you very much for sending that to us. Without further ado, let us move on to our first article.
Yeah, let me find it. Where is it? I need to go forward one page, sorry.
Haiku alpha released.
Yeah, but I'm taking my article as the starting point.
Okay.
There we go. Well, I think everybody pretty much got the gist, especially since we devoted two front page items to a single release of a single... technically very insignificant little operating system, and we devoted two entire items to it. But that's kind of because OS News has its roots set in the whole BOS world, because Eugenia came from... I have to put that differently. OS News existed before Eugenia got here. OS News existed since 1997, but it was not updated that often. It was relatively intermittent. And it wasn't until somewhere in 2001 when Eugenia joined that OS News really took off. But Eugenia came from BNews, so right from the start, from the the first the big resurrection of OS News in 2001, that was all done by someone who was really into the BOS. And well, Eugenia is that much into BOS that she actually met her husband, a B engineer, through the IRC channels, arguing about BOS. So it's kind of, that's where we, that's the history of OS News, where OS News has its roots. And, Eugenia, of course, also came from BNews, so she took a couple of things that she learned in the BNews days, and she took it to OS News. And ever since the beginning, we've been really, we're biased for and against a lot of things, according to people, and most of those accusations are complete nonsense. But one of them is a completely 100% accurate, that we are all, at least me and Eugenia, are very much biased for the BOS. So when Well, the Haiku Alpha, when it was announced that it was going to be released somewhere in September, that was already big news for us, and it already made a big splash in the front page. And you know, it's just an announcement of a alpha release coming out somewhere between now and 2 months, and that was kind of weird. And then when the date had actually got released, which was Monday 2 weeks ago, we did two big items on it, and one big article for me, and then more to the point release announcement from Eugenia. And but it deserves it because it's been 8 years. They've been developing this thing for 8 years, and you know, I followed that development relatively closely. And it started out as a bunch of small, you know, individual replacements where you would install, you know, the normal BOS, the regular BOS R5, and then you would take out the tracker from that was included in the standard R5, and then you would install OpenTracker, which came from the then still called OpenBOS project. And there were a number of other items there. So, for instance, the OpenBFS was completed quite well, not necessarily completed, but usable from a much earlier stage than the actual alpha release. So it's also used by it was also used by WebSkyOS. So it's already pretty stable. But now we're 8 years later, and now they have an actual alpha release, and it's very usable, much more usable than many of you would have probably anticipated. I already knew how usable it was because I regularly hang out in the IRC channel and talk with some of the developers and how far they're along. And I know that most of them have been using Haiku actually to develop on for quite a while now. So I knew how stable it was, but it's still alpha, so you'll still, you know, encounter your actual problems. But I found that most of the problems are related to a lack of hardware support, and not necessarily because it is unstable or it crashes a lot. It will still crash a lot compared to your, you know, to your Windows or your Mac OS X desktop, obviously. But it's not as bad as you would have anticipated, and that's kind of a testament to the attention to detail and the focus on quality that these guys have. It's almost like they're a professional organization trying to put out a finished product that needs to sell and everything. And they've put a lot of attention to every little detail. And if you follow the IRC channels for a while or the mailing list, you really see that they can obsess over really small detail. And that may seem a little bit petty here and there, but it as you know, it and it might take things longer. It might mean that a release comes later, or comes later rather than sooner, but the end result is that you get a release that is much more stable than alpha releases from other projects. I mean, these days a beta release is a final release, and an alpha release is a beta release. So having an alpha release which is probably closer to beta quality in this day and age, that's really awesome. And I really like it that they take their time, and I'd rather have them release something good in 10 years than have them release something crappy in 5 years. I mean, that's basically the whole story for me. So I'm very happy with the alpha release, and it's a really good base to work from. There's a lot of it's not just a recreation of the BOS. They also made some improvements, some big, some improvements really big, some really small, like that they updated the interface and made it look a little bit more modern, while still making it, you know, instantly recognizable as being the BOS. It's got some really cool visual updates that just make it look a little bit more modern, so you don't get the feeling that you're using something from 1999. So that's pretty cool, and I'm really happy with it. So I think they're on the right track here. I did pose at the end of my article the question of what's going to happen once we reach the final release of R1, because right now they have a really clear goal of what they want to achieve, and that clear goal keeps everyone, you know, keeps all the noses pointed in the same direction. And it's I'm a little bit weary about what's going to happen when R1 is released. But I've been, you know, I've been some of the developers said to me, "Well, don't worry, we've got some really good plans for what's going to happen after R1, after R1, R1, and it's not going to be that much of a problem. So, you know, just stay put and relax, and things won't go wrong." So let's
So
just hope
what's
that.
the difference between R1 and R5? Because I don't fully understand these R numbers.
Oh, sorry. No, R1 is meaning Haiku R1, and R stands for release. So Haiku
Oh,
release
right, but
one.
Haiku R1 implements BIOS R5.
Yeah, and R5 is the
The last release of,
last
yes.
release of BOS, and R1, they just use the R number. So you got R1, which is the first release of Haiku, but you also got BOS DR, like for instance DR3 or DR3.5 and DR4, which are developer release.
Yes.
Then you got the R, which is just release without the developer. If I'm not mistaken, it might be that the R stands for something else, but I believe it's for release. At least that's what it means in any case. So that's what it means. Yeah.
Yeah, well, one of the things is that I've never used BIOS before, and
Shame on you.
certainly no had no experience of it in at the time. I think here in Britain it was more RISC OS than it was BIOS, and so I'm coming to the operating system as something completely new, but I also understand that obviously it is a very true to form re-implementation of an older operating system, and that is alone is a massive, massive undertaking to have both source and binary compatibility on a complete clean room implementation. And they've kept extremely their goal has been exceptionally clear, because I mean there's other projects that have tried to re-implement or to homage older operating systems, like say Roxfiler on Linux, which is sort of it tries to be RISC OS on Linux but fails miserably because Linux is not RISC OS and the other way around. Whereas this is they've really kept true to it, and that must have been exceptionally difficult to do, and part of the reason maybe why it's taken so long to do. But I have to applaud that. What my concerns were, is that just like you're saying, what do you do once you have got it released? Because having used, I got the Haiku to boot on my EPC, which was fantastic. I couldn't boot it on the Mac or on the inside a virtual machine, but it did boot on the EPC, and it's an operating system that's obviously at this stage I can't really do very much with, because I don't know what to do with it, and there's too little hardware support. I mean, if Wi-Fi was working, then arguably I could probably do my job with it, carrying it around and Googling problems and so forth and downloading stuff. But that hardware is just not there yet, but should be in the future. In fact, there are check-ins at the moment, aren't there, for adding Wi-Fi?
Yeah, there's some basic there's a for when it comes to the network drivers, they have a sort of free BS, no, free BSD compatibility layer for regular network drivers, and it's not a drop-in, it's not drop-in compatibility, but I believe they need to be recompiled and changed a little, changed and recompiled a little bit before you can no, changed a bit and recompiled, that's the correct order of words here, before you can use them. And they're implementing something similar for wireless drivers, so there have been some basic success in connecting to wireless networks from Haiku, but it's not in any way ready for, you know, major for a release like an alpha or anything. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done here, but the basics are getting done. There's frameworks in there's rudim there are rudimentary frameworks being put into place at this as we speak, basically. So there's improvements in that area as well. So they're moving towards. Yeah,
And
sure.
using the operating system, I'm not familiar with the apps, I'm not familiar with what to do with it, and the layout and everything like that. And of course that's fine. I mean, any operating system you use that's new, it's going to be new. But it feels, and I don't mean this in a bad way, it feels very much like Windows 95. It's extremely minimal. You know, when Explorer in Windows 95 was a spatial browser before they had the whole, you
Yeah,
know,
sure. It is spatial. Yeah, technically,
and
you can set it to you can set Tracker to do it in a in a browser mode. By the way, there's a
I
little
didn't
set
know
for it.
that. Yeah, so it feels a bit like Windows 95, and I don't mean that in a bad way, because when I was using Windows 95 when it originally came out, it was the bee's knees. That was a really good operating system because it was such a step forward. And
Well,
what was I going to say?
I actually really like the way it looks, because, you know, these days you have to have like transparency and all that nonsense waving around before you can actually do anything.
Yeah,
But
it's
I
very
think
true
it,
to form and just
yeah, but it's not
extremely
just true to
straightforward.
form. It still looks really, really good as far as I'm concerned. It may remind you of Windows 95, but I think it looks very modern actually, because it's kind of not retro, but truly modern, and I kind of like that. It's probably my judgment is clouded by the fact that I used BOS full time for a really long time, so I'm, you know, really into the whole thing. And for me, it's just, you know, it really feels like how BOS would have looked like 2003-ish, 2004-ish, if it had continued to be developed. And I'm pretty much fine with that. I mean, a lot of, I mean, I still think that the Windows Classic, the interface that, you know, if you still have that option, I think it's a little bit outdated, but it still looks pretty good. It's pretty, you know, nailed down. And I have the same. No, let me put it this way. I think the way that Haiku looks now, I also said that in the article, it really reminds me of how I perceive macOS 9 now. macOS 9, the way it looks, the Platinum interface is downright perfect. It's so brilliantly beautiful and elegant and simple, yet everything has been worked on for so long, because that's a continuation of an interface that started being developed in the early 80s, and it's been all developed all the way up until like 999 or 2000. I'm not exactly sure when 9.2 was released, but that is something that has been perfected so much and so many times and so many to all the little details that it looks so perfectly well. And I kind of get the same I hate this word, but I kind of get the same vibe from Haiku. It's the BOS interface was already pretty good. I mean, it was simple, but it was very, very, very much usable, and it had its own little thing going, and it really worked very well, at least for me. And what the Haiku guys did was keep all the behavior is exactly the same, but they smooth, on a more truly graphical, from a truly more graphical viewpoint, they made everything a little bit smoother. So there's a little bit more anti-aliasing here and there, and it's smoother. It's got some gradients, and that makes it all look just a little bit more modern and better. But I don't really think that for now they should not focus on anything else. But getting the operating system itself up to speed. And one thing that they could add interface-wise are shadows, because Haiku is pretty much gray. BOS was very gray too, so it's really focused on being gray. And that means that if you have a couple of overlapping windows, it's really difficult to, see where one window ends and the other one starts, the window underneath. So it would be kind of nice to have shadows. And I mentioned that in the to one of the developers, and it technically should be possible, but it's not, of course, not a priority right now, so they shouldn't work on that now. But if they added that, I'd be completely delighted with the way the interface is now. But then again, like I said, I'm a BOS veteran, so for me, this is for me, the BOS interface was already pretty much close to as close to perfection as it could get for me, with all the, especially behaviorally, because things like right-clicking on a window, right-clicking on a tab, and tab as in the title bar in BOS, would send it to back, and double click would minimize it. It's just that negates the need for any other window management features, because you can manage your windows from a place where it makes sense, namely the window. So you don't need to do anything like expose or taskbar thumbnails and all that nonsense, because you can just, if you can send a window to back and you can minimize them by double clicking, that's all you need, basically. That's one of the reasons why I like KDE so much, because in KDE you can set behavior in exactly the same way. So for me, what I'm trying to say is that I might not be the right person to judge Haiku's appearance or behavior, because for me it's BOS, and the BOS was perfect as it was doing its thing.
Well,
So.
the actual skin, the pixels are that's all subjective anyway, and I think it looks perfectly fine as you say. Some of the actual UI paradigms I find quite odd, especially the tracker. I find that quite obtuse sitting in the corner in that way because
That's the death bar.
is that what's it called? Right.
That's the desktop. Tracker is the file manager on the desktop,
Oh right,
and
okay, but the thing in the top right-hand corner, that's the track desk bar. See that it's kind of in a awkward position because you've got this right-hand thing, but it doesn't stretch to the bottom of the screen, and it's
You
too
can drag it
wide.
around.
And you
You can drag
can
it around. You can't set it as a regular taskbar. Now, for me, deskbar, don't say anything bad about deskbar, because deskbar in the top right corner, that's absolutely fracking perfect. Because every little application gets its one single entry, and it gets a little menu where you can manage all
Yes,
your windows. You can
but so
also
for
set them
example.
to, you can set them to auto expand, so that you got tracker, and then you got a listing in a different color underneath of all the various windows that belong to all the chat windows that belong to that process. I think it's,
Yeah,
again, it's absolutely brilliant.
but
I
when you
love it.
maximize a window, it ends up covering up over the right-hand side of the tracker, whereas I would prefer the maximization to not cover the tracker, not the tracker, sorry, the desk bar.
Why would you maximize a window?
Sorry?
Why would you maximize a window? That's kind of a sort of hypothetical question, because I don't really expect an
But
answer, but
I was
I
on a
don't.
low resolution. I was 1024 6 768 or 1024 600, so
Yeah.
Firefox naturally maximize it because it's only 1024
That's
wide
true.
anyway. But the thing
Yeah.
is if I were maximizing windows, I would expect them exclude the desk bar at the right hand side, because if you
Oh, you
cover it,
can.
then you've got to then manually resize your window so you can get back to your thing. It's just
Now you can set the desk bar to not be covered by windows. So for instance, you could put it at the bottom of the screen, like in the Windows taskbar, so that it would just cover the entire bottom end of the screen, like
Ah,
in a
right.
regular.
Okay. That would be a
Then
good
you could
one, I'm
tell it
sure.
to not be covered by windows. But it's not the default setting. The default setting in BOS is top right corner,
Yeah.
and
I've got
so
to
that's the
root
default.
for all the various options and so forth.
Yeah.
And they've got and obviously I need to get through what apps are actually worthwhile using. There's Firefox on there, but it's an old version. It's Firefox
Yeah,
2,
true.
and it's not a native BIOS application by any long
Firefox
stretch of the
doesn't belong.
imagination. And I can tell that straight away, having never used BIOS, that the Firefox is quite an out of place.
Yeah, I don't like BO I don't like Firefox in general, but on BOS it's even worse. It doesn't belong there. It's I mean, it's kind of the, you know, the black sheep of the family. It just shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be on the disc. It shouldn't be anywhere near the elegance and beauty of the BOS. There should be no Firefox there. It should. I'm really hoping that the project that Ryan Liefengood and his GSSC student is working on will pick up some steam really soon. They've got made some major progress on their WebKit browser. I forgot the name. I don't know from the top of my head, but that's really something that I'm looking forward to. To have a proper WebKit is much more aligned with the BOS goals and a simple, to the point browser. They're working on implementing a Chrome-like multi-process thing, where you know every tab gets its own little process. They've got some work done on that one as well. I believe they were even able to already have different tabs with different threads, different processes, which is you know really aligns very well with the multi-threading goal of the BOS. So.
Now that the BOS Haiku has reached this stage and obviously going onwards towards finalization, they've got to deal with new UI concepts and certainly new hardware and new things that have happened in the industry since BOS, like wireless hardware. They've got to somehow fit in some UI for configuring this and all, and that's treading new ground, and I think that's going to be the interesting thing because you've got to meet these new paradigms and new features and new technologies in a BOS fashion.
Well, that's a good example of that. If you go to page 3 of the article that I wrote, there's a touchpad panel now. That was never in BOS. So
no,
that's completely designed by them from the ground up. And I think it looks absolutely perfect. Very simple. It looks very simple to the point, you know, maybe the word step size isn't, very accessible. But for the rest, I think it's really cool. It has the little thing that says two-finger scrolling, multi-finger scrolling. It shows how large the scroll areas are. There's a tap gesture thing. You can turn it off. I mean, this is something that not even Windows has. Windows does not, by default, have a panel to configure a touchpad. It doesn't have it. You have to use your, at least as far as I know, on the various different laptops that I've tried, you have to install the actual drivers for your touchpad. So most of the time that would be Synaptic. To get this kind of control over your touchpad. For the rest, in Windows, it will just show up as a PS2 mouse, and that's it. And you have no control. You can't turn off tapping, which is the most annoying feature in the history of ever. So you'd need special drivers and everything. And here, it's just built in right from the ground up. And I think it's really awesome. I mean, Linux only got this stuff about a year ago or something. It never had it from the get-go either. macOS 10 obviously had it because of the whole vertical integration nonsense. So they had it from the get go. But for the rest, other operating systems didn't have this for a very long time. And Haiku got this from the get go, and I think that's really awesome. But in any case, this panel shows that they can design a good panel that wasn't usually in. They can design a good UI that wasn't usually that wasn't before in the BOS. So they know what they're doing. Let me just put it like
yes.
that.
Yes, and as you were saying. Once they've got to a beta release or beyond that, because now this is an open source operating system, they've got the opportunity now that there could be Haiku distributions. People can spin off distributions of Haiku and make something else. And whilst it might sound scary in some instances, I think it's also going to allow for the necessary experimentation to find out new ways of bringing in the UI to make it more modern in the sense of the more modern tasks that we have with computer CD burning and DVD burning and DVD playback and so on and so forth, just a bunch of stuff.
Well, the rules for Haiku distributions are pretty strict, especially when it comes to all the artwork and the Haiku name. Trademarks, whatever. That's really, really strict. You really need to strip everything out, and there's some set of rules that you need to implement before you can call yourself a distribution. But it's pretty cool. And on the other hand, I mean, there is a fear that that it will end in a kind of Linuxy situation with 10 million distributions that all suck, and then maybe one or two that are good, and that will just confuse people. But I just point towards FreeBSD or NetBSD or whatever. And there's one FreeBSD, and there are a couple of others, but in the end, everybody knows what FreeBSD is, and they do it well. And I think Haiku is going to be. There won't be a lot of distributions. I mean, it's a small project still, and there won't be 10 million distributions. And if Haiku just sticks to delivering something that resembles the BOS, they're going to be fine. There won't be any people who will do anything right there. So I'm not scared on that subject. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing aspect about it is with them re-implementing an older desktop operating system from that era is about the problem of well, I mean, one, it's a massive undertaking anyway, building an operating system from scratch, because you've got so much problem with hardware now. It's the game is so much bigger, and also facing potential obsolescence. Is this going to be something that will only ever appeal to BIOS, previous BIOS users, or is it going to be able to attract a new crowd and a new set of users and a new set of devices for that too?
I have absolutely no idea. There's no way to tell. I mean, there's no way to tell. I mean, look at AROS, for instance. I mean, they're more or less similar to Haiku. They did a not they're not source compatible, and they're also not binary compatible. But it's more or less the same thing. But then, you know, with the Amiga OS as the ancestor and not BOS. And I don't think that AROS has been very successful in attracting new people. I'm not sure. I mean, I have no idea. I've never really looked into the whole thing. So it's going to be difficult. I mean, that's for sure. But I think Haiku does have an advantage in that Haiku is much closer to BOS than AROS is to the Amiga. And on top of that, I think there is more love for the BOS. It's also a little bit more recent. There's more love for the BOS, and there are more people interested in the BOS than that there are people interested in the Amiga. So, and on top of that, the Amiga is much older and much less modern than even the original BOS. I mean, no protected memory, no this, no that. It's all relatively basic. It's cool and it's fun, but it's technically, it used to be technologically on the forefront of everything, and it was 10 years ahead of everybody else. But now they're more like 20 years behind, right? So 15 years, I'm sorry. More like 10 to 15 years behind. But the BOS, while it is behind in some areas, it still is in front of everybody else in a number of other areas. So they've still got a lot to capitalize on, but they do have to be quick about it. I mean, in a couple of years, the situation is going to be different, and if they wait another 5 to 10 years, the BOS will be where the Amiga OS is now. I mean, it used to be advanced once, but it's now an obsolete, well, toy. But the BOS is still, you know, except for the lack of hardware support,
Relevant.
still very much usable and very much a competitive piece of work, especially because it's so ridiculously fast and it's so much more responsive than anything else out there. I mean, forget Windows, forget you know, the Mac OS X, forget Linux that need 10 million cores just to display a friggin' web page. I mean, the BOS is not like that. It can run on a really constrained set of hardware that's very limited and still be able to deliver a very fast and very smooth experience. You just look at the VESA driver. I mean, compare the VESA driver in Haiku to any other VESA driver you've ever seen, and it's going to be night and day. A VESA driver on any operating system is a mess. It's slow, redraw takes like 10 million seconds or 10 million minutes before something happens, and then the BOS is perfectly usable. I mean, I wrote the entire review here using a VESA driver, and it worked completely fine. Of course, it's slower than having a native driver, and I'm still looking for a supported video card to shove in my machine so I can, you know, have a better experience. But overall, it's still pretty much usable, and that's just testament to the lightness of it all. And I think that's one of the major selling points. It's so tiny and fast and clever, and that's going to attract a lot of geeks. And what you need here is a geek. You don't need people who asking questions about why are we still doing this and it's useless and we all have Windows, so who cares? You don't need those people. Forget those people. What you need is geeks. You need people like us, but then with coding skills. That's basically what you need. And the BOS still has that name. BOS still has a name and a reputation, and people are coming. And when a couple of days around the release, I was still in the IRC channel. I haven't been there for a couple of days now. And you could see the visitor level rise from 60 to 160, and it stuck there, stuck on 160, and people were still. I'm currently not logged in, but it was. It rose and it stayed there. It wasn't something that just there for a couple of days and that's it. But even if you look at all the other websites that covered it, I mean, Ars Technica covered it. We covered it, obviously. PC World covered it. Slashdot took it over. It's a lot of major websites reported on this one. That just shows there's still so much love for the BOS, and rightly so, of course. So there's still a lot of people that like it, a lot of people that remember it as well. I mean, a lot of people remember it, and that's good. But wait, like I said, wait another 5 to 10 years, and there won't be as many people remembering it, and there won't be PC World, and there won't be Ars Technica reporting on it. So there is a window, and that window is obviously, as you know, as time goes by, that window will grow smaller, not grow smaller, will close. more and more until there's no more windmill, and you'll just have, you know, crusty old people like me saying, you know, waving a walking stick around and saying how good everything was 10 years ago. So yeah, they do have to. They can't rest on their laurels now that there's an alpha release. I know that they are not resting on their laurels. Even during the alpha release, there were continuously code drops, or what do you call it? What do you call it when you submit a piece of code? And it, commits. There were countless commits to the main branch, or the non-alpha branch, or the branch that was still being developed. There were still numerous commits on that branch, and it continued to go on and on. And now, of course, there's a whole lot of bug fixing going on. So if they ever get to another alpha release, it's going to be a lot more stable, because a lot of major bugs will be worked out. There will be a lot more information on various different hardware configurations. So, you know, like device IDs that can be added, and USB support that can be improved. And so this alpha release is a really good thing to happen for them. So
let's move on.
Yeah. We should. Let me. Okay, what are we going to talk about?
Has Microsoft missed the boat with mobile?
I need to go back one page. We got two items on that one. We actually got your editorial, and then a couple of days later, I wrote something about that as well. Yeah, there we go. Click. There we go. This is your topic. Take it away.
Okay. It's... I don't know. Just concerned with the lack of coherence with Microsoft's effort when it comes to their mobile strategy. I think I summed it up best when by saying, I'm left imagining that Microsoft has 100 separate departments all rushing to compete with Apple on their own. Sorry, I'm a bit lost with this actually.
Well, the basic problem is, of course, that basically what you just said. I mean, if you just look at it, we got Windows Mobile 6.5 coming out. Then Windows Mobile 7 is coming. Then we have the Zune, which probably runs something akin to Windows Mobile 2, akin to Windows Mobile as well. I have no idea what it's running, but it has its own little app store that you can't submit anything to. And then there's going to be a Windows Mobile 6.5 app store, and then there has to be a separate section in that app store that's going to come for Windows Mobile 7 because it has additional features. And 6.5 and 7 are going to coexist at the same time, and 6.5 is for people with less money, and 7 is for people with more money, and it's going to have different feature sets, and people are going to be confused, and people are going to not buy that crap, and that's basically the problem here. Instead of what Microsoft should just do is, just get 6.5 out of the way now and completely focus on on Windows Mobile 7. It doesn't matter if it gets released next December or next January. It doesn't matter. Just work it and make it good, and stay in very close contact with your device makers, and make sure that they have at least that they all implement the exact same feature set. So they can differentiate on having a better camera or not, but the basic feature has to be the same. So you have to have a multi-touch screen. It has to be this size, and it has to be this resolution, period. And if you do not conform, then you will not get Windows Mobile 7. Forget it. Trust me, the device makers will step in line right away, because Windows Mobile, while sucking, is still very popular, especially in the business world. And device makers need Windows Mobile handsets to, you know, because they sell well. That's basically the whole thing. So device makers will step in line, and that's what Microsoft should do. They should not go back to the days of having multiple offerings. So they're going to have three offerings. They're going to have the operating system that runs on the Zune that has its own development model and everything. Then they're going to have 6.5. Then they're going to have 7. I mean, what's? I have no idea who is making up this strategy, especially since Steve Ballmer has been talking so much about that they've messed up in the mobile area, and admitting to that they've messed up. And then they do something like this. I have no idea. Why isn't the operating system running on the Zune HD, the exact same thing that's going to run, that's going to be released as Windows 7? Why doesn't it have the same interface except for the phone part? Why don't they learn from whatever Apple is doing, except, of course, don't copy the whole thing about not being able to install applications on your own? then just do that, and they're going to have winner, because, you know, contrary to what everybody believes, Microsoft does have a lot of very bright people working there and a lot of bright developers that can come up with really cool stuff. Because if you look at the Zune, even though the browser is a piece of crap, I'm sure that the people actually working on the Zune really wanted WebKit. I'm pretty sure that they really wanted WebKit, not some weird EA6 monstrosity thing. I mean, if you look at the interface for the Zune, and if you look at the interface for the Xbox 360, Microsoft knows how to make an easy-to-use, pretty interface that does a lot of cool stuff. They can compete in that area with Apple. They've shown that in the past, say, year. About if you take Windows 7 into account, they know how to make something that looks good and works well and has a bunch of very sound ideas behind it. It's just that it's a company that works in committees. It's kind of like City Hall, or like the DMV or the Department of Motor Vehicles. I mean, there's a lot of different areas and a lot of different departments, and they all have their own little room, their own little group, and their own managers, and those managers don't talk to the managers across the hall because, I don't know, they don't drink coffee or something. I have no idea. It's a completely, all these tiny little islands that don't talk to each other. I mean, if you buy a Zune, you can't even use Windows Media Player. You have to use some custom thing. What are these people thinking? Are they just idiots, and I just don't believe that the developers at Microsoft are idiots. No, they're not idiots. It's that upper layer, those people who've never coded before. The people in suits and ties and all those weirdos that, that get all excited when the new Mercedes comes out. Those kinds of people are ruining everything. There are a lot of, those are the same people that ruined Windows NT when it was first released. Those are the people who turn this really elegant thing called Windows NT, and they turned it into Windows 2000 and Windows XP and these horrible things where all the cool security stuff was completely discarded because they were idiots. And I don't like Microsoft management. I don't like management in general, but I really don't like Microsoft management because they're worse. So I think that's kind of what's going wrong here with Microsoft's mobile strategy. I mean, it's not working out, and it's not working out not because of the developers or because they can't develop a mobile operating system. It's not working out because they have the wrong managers. They have managers that only look at the bottom line and not at delivering a good product, which in the end will be better. And it might mean that you won't be able to release something between now and next December. Well, just suck it up. I mean, if you want to build for the future, you can't think about tomorrow. You have to think about next year. And I mean, that's what Apple's been doing with this whole iPhone thing. I mean, they've... I believe the first signs of there being an iPhone, you can already see that in macOS 10 and in the frameworks that there are there. They're really thinking not about tomorrow, they're thinking about next year, about the next iPhone and what's that going to have. I may not like the iPhone. But it's
hang on a sec, sorry, I've lost you.
What?
Are you there? Okay, sorry, Skype sort of blinked out a little bit there just as you were finishing.
Oh, so it's, where did it stop?
I think that was clear enough anyway.
Okay.
What was I going to add? Yes, Microsoft are just not reusing what they've got. Why on earth do they not improve Windows Media Player to have podcasts like iTunes has had since, version 4.9 or something? And instead you've got to install the Zune Player. And of course, Zune doesn't work on Mac, and most students are using Mac. So, again, they've cornered themselves there. They could have at least clobbered up a little basic utility for syncing with Mac, and it would have helped them a lot. Nobody's talking to each other here in Microsoft. And my article was coming from my point of view, which is where my experience lies, which is with the Internet Explorer thing. And that where they've basically been sitting on their ass doing absolutely nothing for years and years and years with Internet Explorer 6, their code base has been overtaken by everybody else to such a huge extent that it's almost completely impossible for them to catch up now. And if they're going to provide an excellent browsing experience on the Zune, then Internet Explorer will never, ever, ever provide that. Are they going to be able to suck it in and swallow their pride and just use use WebKit, use something proper, use something usable?
Well, it would be a really, really cool piece of news if Microsoft did indeed do that. And I mean, I just don't know what they're thinking. I mean, they're slowly, very, very slowly starting to get their act together on the Office side of things, with Office 2007 and the new interface, and they're slowly getting their act together on the desktop side with Windows 7. But when it comes to the mobile, it's just, I don't know what they're thinking by having three different, technically different mobile operating systems and different app stores and browsers that just cannot compete with what the competition has to offer. I mean, Palm has a WebKit browser and so does the iPhone, and they're basically the same thing, just with a different user agent. You know, and they all work very, very well. So why would you be so weird as just continue to use the Internet Explorer-based mobile browser? And it's not technically EA6, so it's not the mobile version might be called, you know, Internet Explorer 6, but it's not the same as the desktop version of EA6. So it is more modern, blah blah, but it's still light years behind everybody else. So why not just suck it up and start using WebKit? I mean, there's no shame in using WebKit. Palm does it, Google does it, Apple does it. I mean, it would be so much easier for everyone. And I think that even within Microsoft itself, a lot of people are thinking, why aren't we using WebKit? It's better than what we have to offer. It's lighter. It's I just don't understand what they're doing. It's kind of annoying, actually.
Yeah, the products are just not going to be able to compete against iPhone until they get this together. They've got the programming talent. I just yeah, it's again, it's managerial thing really. And unless they can sort out their management, then they're going to become second fiddle. And the finishing point on my article was essentially that Microsoft are years behind everybody else when it comes to competing, and they're finding themselves in a position that they're not leading the way. They're not the innovators anymore. The web is in general, and Apple are in general, and Microsoft are having the rug being pulled out from underneath their feet, and that's not a good position to be in. Yes, the desktop market is not going to change. They're always going to sell a lot of copies of Windows, etc. But if everybody else is, of all the new features are in everybody else's operating system first, then you know that's a serious problem.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's. Do you want to move on?
Yeah.
Anything else to add to that? The next thing we want to cover is. This or just see where the discussion goes about Opera, because I've trolled about Opera before, and I don't particularly like it. I don't, yeah, that's all personal opinion though. So, what I wanted to do is ask the community, you know, what they think Opera should basically do, because the market, the facts are quite simple. Their market share is extremely low, and they're hemorrhaging market share in the American market. What should they do? Regardless of what my opinion is, that's basic fact, and that's backed up by a BBC News article that's an interview with the who is it actually? Let's just read
John von
this.
Techner, the
Oh, I actually
CEO.
managed to pronounce it. That's it. The CEO, who's saying that Opera want to increase their market in the market share in America. And my points that I was holding up before were simply that Opera isn't a compelling brand. Opera just isn't a word that I think resonates well outside of Europe, and that the browser should be called something else, and then Opera be the company and the browser be something else. And the Mozilla are suffering something similar in China, that they're having very great difficulty being adopted in China, and it could be a cultural phenomenon in some way, that the Firefox brand just doesn't resonate with people, and that in China more people are using Internet Explorer shells like Maxthon and things like that, and that's eating into the Internet Explorer share, but ultimately it's still Trident at the end of the day, so it's not changing anything as far as diversity is concerned. The other factor I was concerned about with Opera is that I think they're being a bit well, they need a movement, not just a product. Firefox have done exceptionally well. Mozilla have done exceptionally well with their stance on the open web, and their evangelism work as far as that's concerned. And that Opera should also stand for something, in the web browser market, rather than just being yet another commercial product.
I think one of the problems that I see with Opera is that it's trying to be too much. I mean, why is Chrome doing so relatively well, and why is it already in a lot of areas more popular than Opera? Because it is a browser and nothing more. It is a browser, and that's what it is. You enter a web page, and it shows the web page. It's miraculous. That's what it is. That's what it does, and it does nothing more. And that's what people like, I think. At least that's what I think. I mean, I'm just, you know, some random guy. But anyway. That's what I think. Firefox is technically the same thing. It's a browser. It's nothing more. It's a little window, and I don't think it works as well as Chrome. But anyway, it's a browser. It shows a web page. That's it. It has this marvelous extension framework thing where you can add all sorts of stuff that you need, and there's something there for everyone. It's really cool. But Opera is trying to cram everything in. So when you first open Opera, you see 10 million things on your screen, and you have no idea what they are. It's very daunting. I mean, they can polish it up with paint and everything, but it's still, I think, at least from my perspective, it's too much. They tried to be too much. I think that Opera would have a much bigger chance if they just released a browser with their engine, and which is, you know, I have no idea, I have no understanding about engines, but a lot of people say it's very fast. Okay, I believe you. Just release a browser, make it a browser, and then take out the email part and release that as an application. Take out the whole you can integrate BitTorrent, probably. That's probably a handy feature. But take all that stuff out and just release a browser. You can still have the full-fledged Opera super thing for the people that really want it, because there are a lot of people that still want that. Okay, that's awesome. But just release a browser and just release a browser with a window with a back button, a forward button, a stop button, a little thing where you enter the address and a search field, and just put it out there, and people will love it. People will will use it. Maybe, like you said, introduce a new name. I have no idea, and just release it like that, and don't have this massive application. And massive, I don't mean massive in size. A lot of people, you know, immediately start commenting, "Yeah, but it's only 6 megabytes." It's not about the actual size of the binary. It's about the size of the application, and when you look at the number of features it has, Opera can do anything except make me coffee. It's insane, and while that's really cool for those that need it, I don't think, I think most people do not want a browser like that. And if you look at the figures, it shows, right?
I think a running theme through the comments was that of obsolescence. Opera is facing ever greater obsolescence.
On the desktop, get comments on the desktop, because they're doing really well on mobile side. So, yeah.
Yes, but even that, they're facing obsolescence as well. It's become an engine wars. The browser wars 2.0 is about engines, not about individual user agents.
Did you just say browser wars 2.0?
Yeah.
just checking. Go on.
And because it's become engine wars, it means that individual browsers are becoming sidestepped. I had mentioned in my comments amongst everybody else is that they're facing the problem of these mobile operating systems that have the browser integrated, or in fact even based on a browser as a core part of the whole functioning of the operating system, like WebOS, which has got WebKit integrated, and the iPhone, which has got Safari on it, and you're not allowed to install other browsers. So right off the bat there, with those two platforms, Opera are facing a massive problem of obsolescence that a tightly integrated rendering engine is already built into the device, and installing a browser over the top of that is either one, not possible, or two, not as pleasant to do so. And so they don't really have a device that's their own, that's that their rendering engine is at the core of it, except for on the Wii, the Nintendo Wii, their rendering engine is on there, and obviously Opera Mobile and Opera Mini are massively popular, massively popular on all the other different various handsets.
Yeah,
but I think they're facing a problem of obsolescence in that. There are so many other browsers now, and there's so many other the share in engines has changed so drastically now that Safari and Chrome and WebKit has grown just so phenomenally, that the actual Opera browser itself is becoming less and less a requirement than when it was, as it was a choice between IE6, Mozilla Suite, and Opera, and clearly Opera was the winner in that, in that its market share in Europe is significantly higher.
Yeah. Well, I never really denied that I do not like Opera. I don't think it's just not, like I said, it's just not my thing. And what I just said about just releasing browsers, of course, you know, that's just the way that I look at it, and I'm sure a lot of people will think differently about that one. But I kind of agree with it. It's not a compelling brand. I mean, it's. No, I just don't like it, and they need to change some things. And I think the market, maybe not necessarily in Europe, but in the rest of the world, the market right now is not really favorable to a closed source web browser that's just a web browser and not something that can be integrated, like you said, into other platforms and anything. So I'm not saying that they should go open source, because that probably won't help them anyway. But if they continue the way that they continue now, they're losing this battle, I think. Okay.
One moment, we've got a. Oh, you'll probably have to add him. One second. We've got. You know, we had an email a couple of weeks ago about a user who wanted to join the show. He's online at the moment.
I vaguely recall something.
Yeah, hang on.
Oh, here we go. I think this one. I don't think I got that. Mike Furlan, is that right?
I don't know.
I'm a proud.
But he would have given his Skype address.
I'd like to offer any help that you guys might need. I might make a cool guest. I use Linux, blah, blah.
I'll just ask him, what's his Skype name? Where'd it go?
Why can't you add him? You can add him too, right?
He's already added. But I don't know what his actual Skype name is.
No, but I mean, add him to the conversation. You can do that too, right?
I can't. I'm not hosting.
Oh, you can't do that if you're not hosting. Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
I think, why shouldn't you? I mean, that would be completely retarded. It would be Skype worthy. I mean, they can't even produce a decent version. There we go.
Oh, we're working. Okay.
Of course that works. Told you.
Hey, guys.
Ah, hi. Huzzah. Hello, hi, good day.
We were just trying to find out whether the person who's not hosting the conversation can actually add a person, and apparently you can. Wait.
So that, plus amazing, my usability, yeah.
Yeah.
Mike, you'll have to introduce yourself. We are recording at this moment, so you don't need to do anything special, just talk.
All right. My name is Mike Furland. I'm one of the editors and contributors to PCNoob.com, as well as a senior technician of all systems repair and shop manager.
And an OS News user, I assume.
Yeah, yeah. Been a long time fan. I missed a lot of Cisco class in high school because of OS News.
Sorry.
No, man, it was definitely time worth, well put into it. So I enjoyed it. So.
Oh, okay, good.
And, my mind is blank. Let's...
Okay, well, we were talking about Opera, weren't we?
Yeah, we're kind of finished with that. Unless there's anything you wanted to... Unless you've got an experience with Opera or any opinions on Opera that you want to add.
Not 100% sure. What's been going on in the news this week? I've been kind of crazy at the shop. I know that SciStar's definitely been getting the brunt end of Apple, and I remember reading something like the court decided not to enjoin the case between.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, let me find that one. We could probably talk about that one. That's okay. Let me find it. Apple's motion. There we go. Yeah, I mean, basically, there was Apple. Let me get this right. Apple sued SciStar because of them selling non-Apple labeled computers with macOS 10 pre-installed. And then that lawsuit was ongoing and blah, 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 lots of stuff going on there. And then Apple released Snow Leopard. And SciStar more or less filed a similar case, but then not regarding Leopard, but regarding Snow Leopard, a separate case, and they filed that in the state of Florida. And Apple wanted to have those two cases joined together so that the case from Florida would be transferred to the original case in California, so that it could all be handled at the same time. But in order to do that, the discovery phase had to be reopened and extended for like 30 days or something. And the judge already made clear that he wasn't really fond of it, but he asked Apple to make a proper motion to have them enjoined. But then the judge denied it, and the reason why he denied it was pretty interesting. Because originally Apple continuously said during the case, no, Snow Leopard, it's not the same as Leopard, it's not part of this case, and we shouldn't deal with it, it's not interesting, we shouldn't do that now. And then the judge said, well, it's kind of weird that now that you've released Snow Leopard, suddenly it's relevant. So it's that's kind of weird. So the judge said, no, Apple, you can't do that. But there's still an opening here, because Apple is still allowed to file a motion in Florida to have the judge on the other side of the country to still have it joined. So if that judge says, look, I do believe that the case should be joined, then it will be joined. So it's still, there's still an opening here, but it is kind of a loss for Apple, but it's kind of a silly loss because they played this one out really, really badly by first continuously saying, no, it's no lab, but it's different. It's not part of this case. And then asking, can it please be made part of the case? I mean, it's kind of weird. This doesn't work.
So, I wonder if they've been drinking their own Kool-Aid. That's all I have to say. the funny thing about all of this is, you know, in the past, we saw that, back in the old days, like around, I think it was like 99, when Rasputi came out, what later became OS 10.
Yeah.
When they first put out the developer, preview of that stuff, it was, x86 and PowerPC.
Yeah.
And then only in later years did we see Apple actually moved to the x86 platform, but it's weird because I actually look at some of those screenshots, and a guy like me that's a computer enthusiast, I've done the Hackintosh thing a couple times myself, and I see the same like Darwin bootloader like back in some of the screenshots of Rasputi counting down the video RAM and all that stuff, and press like dash V or whatever to start in verbose and stuff, and it's like, wow. Maybe a lot of stuff under the hood hasn't really changed much from then, it's a really interesting situation for Apple, because, there is this community that wants to, put OS 10 on a PC and make it work for everybody. And then there's, the Apple zealots are like, no way, Jose, this just can't happen.
It's illegal.
Yeah.
Well, we're stealing from Apple.
Well, it's a different thing also when companies want to then go and go on and sell this. I mean, Apple, I suspect, don't even care in the slightest about individual enthusiasts who have the knowledge to build a Hackintosh, because it's not going to affect their bottom line. They're concerned about when this turns into shops and sales,
because they're still
scared about the whole clone era.
Yeah, but isn't it a completely arbitrary difference between...
Oh, it's an arbitrary difference, of course.
It's completely arbitrary.
Apple themselves are scared about.
I mean, I don't think any other business, nobody should care about Apple's bottom line but Apple itself. I mean, it's not my concern, it's not PsyStar's concern, it's not the president's concern, it's not my queen's concern, it's nobody's concern. I mean, it's the only concern of Apple. And if they can't get their act together, and if they can't profit from people wanting Mac OS X on normal machines, then, that's their loss and not, mine, not PsyStar's, and not the queen's. So I think it's kind of, kind of weird that somehow a lot of people seem to think that we have some sort of obligation to protect Apple's bottom line. I don't have an obligation to protect any company's bottom line. I mean, I don't care about companies because they don't care about me, so why should I care about them? So it's
exactly.
I find it really weird to defend a company. No, of course there are reasons to defend a company if they like they make a good product, but you don't defend a company's bottom line. I just don't really understand it. That might just be me. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just a very sticky situation to be in for both those companies, because PsyStar wants to be heralded as the champion of the people for making a Hackintosh that's affordable for the regular Joe. And Apple wants to be the champion of the people to make something that just works, On the other side, the price really makes it prohibitive for a lot of, different, folks out there. And especially in other countries where the import tax gets slapped right on that. And, people, it tends to make people not very happy about buying one of these machines.
I'm amazed you Americans cringe at the thought of spending $1,000 on an Apple laptop. Yeah, mine costs $2,700. Put your head around that.
I believe the price. Yeah, continue.
I can only imagine. Most of the customers I see, when it comes down to like say a laptop that needs like a $200 motherboard, and then a couple hours of labor to slap the thing in, they tend to freak out and they're like, well, what can you do to get this done cheaper? And it's like, well, there's not an awful lot we can do. And then when they, they go out there and they start seeing what the price of laptops are, and they see that, like, they can get the netbook, but nobody want, most of my customers don't want the small screens and the tiny cheap little keyboards. They don't want that. Most people want like a full size laptop.
Yeah, and when most people use them at home anyway, so it's
fine
to have a normal laptop. Yeah.
And then when they go to the Apple store, they're like, oh my God, are you guys serious?
Yeah, I can definitely see that one coming. I mean, I've helped a lot of people to buy Macs, a couple of friends of mine. And the major issue was never the operating system. The major issue was never about, you know, starting to belong to a cult and having to give in your finger. But it's all, you know, it's all been about the price. Every discussion that I've ever had with anyone here who I've helped buying a Mac, and I've, you know, even advised a couple of people to do, like my dad who bought an iMac and I helped him and everything. But the big issue has always been the price, you know, and I can justify the price to some people, especially because it means that I don't have to spend a lot of time fixing their computer. So, you know, two thumbs up for me, but that's the major issue for everyone. And especially like here in the Netherlands, where we're using the euro, and euro is awesome, but Apple hasn't found that out yet. So we're still, and neither did any other company, by the way. Electronics here are, you know, like arbitrarily 20% more expensive than in Germany, even, so let alone the United States. So it's, yeah. They just, you know, replaced the dollar sign with the euro sign. It doesn't matter that that makes it like 20-30% more expensive. So it's, I just don't have this idea. Like, okay, when I need a new computer, my first thought is never, hey, let's buy a Mac. No, my first thought is, how can I make it as cheap as possible?
Yeah.
You know, and I'd really love to buy, you know, like the, okay, I won't be buying a Mac anytime soon, but you know, up until a couple of months ago, I would really love to buy a Mac and, you know, use it and everything, but I just don't have the money. I can't justify spending that much more money on something that's not technically that much better than what the competition has to offer. It is a little bit better, especially the, you know, with the whole aluminium casing and everything, but for the rest, it's not that much better. It's the same processor, the same damn motherboard. It doesn't matter.
So yeah, I think that's really where SciStar tries to compete, is they're like, hey, you know, this hardware really, you know, isn't exactly that unique. And there are, you know, there's a lot of people out there, you know, like us, that know like what is actually inside these machines, and we're like, you know, hey, this is, you know, the same damn Intel motherboard we find in a lot of other, you know, machines, you know, with the same chipsets and stuff. It's just, you know, this thing runs EFI on top of it. And, yeah, you know, it's like, do we really want to pay like a, you know, a 35% price difference on EFI when it's not even really accessible to us, the user? And the average Joe doesn't even know what the hell that means.
Well, there are some reasons, you know, why I would be willing to spend more on an Apple computer. And for me specifically, it's... these days, the quality of the aluminium casing, because I think that's, you know, especially if you look at the laptops, the Pro, so not the polycarbonate white thing, but the metal ones. I think the casing really is better than what the competition has to offer with their plastic nonsense. But
definitely,
I'd be willing to pay more for that, but not that much more.
Yeah, and I think that's you know, even the aluminum casing kind of thing. I mean, a lot of other companies have tried that thing out too. I mean, Toshiba's got the Toughbook. I believe it's Toshiba that makes that thing, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. No, Panasonic.
Oh, Panasonic, yeah. And there are a lot of customers that really appreciate, you know, having that extra durability. Especially, I see it, you know, very more commonplace in places like mechanic shops.
Yeah.
And, you know, that makes a lot of sense. And, I mean, it makes a lot of sense for a lot of these computers to actually start migrating to that kind of design paradigm. But is, like, how much more money are we going to actually have to spend on something like that? I guess that's what it comes to the question of.
Yeah. With the new what's it called, the whatever book thing, whatever, and it's also like completely in aluminium, but and it uses the exact same internals as any other netbook. It has a 3G slot, no SIM card slot and everything, but for the rest it's pretty much similar. It even has less ROM than most of them. It doesn't even have a ROM slot, for God's sake. But it's made in aluminium, so it's $200 more expensive. It's basically the whole thing, and I find that kind of ridiculous. I mean, aluminium is not that much more expensive. I'd be willing to pay $100 more, but not $200.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, it's a cheap material. I mean, why else would, you know, we have soda cans made out of the crap, you know? I mean, even beer cans, man, you know, it all comes down to, it's like, well, hell, if they can make a small bottle out of, you know, 5 cents worth of this stuff, why can't we... Yeah, it's
well,
weird thing.
With the prices for all computers coming down, I think we're all beginning to be more open to the idea of, if something breaks, just buy a new one. I think it's becoming commodity and throwaway. In a way, before you'd spend a lot on a computer hoping to last as long as possible, but here you can't really see up front the much of the reason, because if you buy a computer that's not so expensive and it does break down three years down the line, you know the prices are going to be so much cheaper by then, and availability so good that you could you know, buy another one. It's go for something that can be replaced more often.
Yeah, but I can't do that with an Apple computer. That's kind of my problem, because I've had a lot of Apple machines, and I don't think I've had a single Apple machine that didn't break before its time. And that's kind of what I'm scared of, because you know, even if I buy a 1,200 euro MacBook, and I kind of like the new the 13-inch thing with the aluminium and everything, I think it looks cool. It's thin. It's awesome. But I'm not going to buy it because I'm afraid, at least not from, you know, my own hard-earned money. I mean, if anybody wants to give someone to me, I mean, you know, two thumbs up for me. But if it's my own money, I mean, for $1,200, I mean, 1,200 euros, I mean, I could buy a perfectly capable laptop with a relatively high quality for like 700, 800, maybe 900 euros, and I still have a couple of hundred left to spend on things that I like even more. So it's, and I'm just afraid that it's going to break at some point, because even if you follow like the Mac Fix It websites and all the websites that track that stuff, there's still a lot of stuff wrong with you know,
yeah,
with
the,
Apple
machines. The reliability of Apple's hardware has taken a real nosedive since around 2001. I mean, I remember the old titanium PowerBooks, and those things were obscenely expensive here in the UK. You'd pay around £3,000 for one, but they were just absolutely solid, and there's people still using them now. But ever since really the Intel switch, things have just gone downhill so drastically that there are always major hardware problems with each revision, and they're just not lasting as long as they used to. I mean, with a Mac, you expect it to last a good deal of time.
Yeah, and that idea just doesn't exist anymore. And that's kind of, and of course, on top of the whole thing, like, don't buy Revision A hardware. Why not? Then if Revision A hardware is a problem, why isn't it cheaper? I mean, I just don't understand
just
that. It's a funny thing.
Doctor sticker on it.
It's a funny thing you bring that up, because you remember the whole big iPhone debacle with the first generation iPhone that came out, and everybody was all hot and over it, and then, you know, they released it at like a $300 price point originally, didn't they?
$600.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, this is Revision A hardware. And then, you know, Apple's like, hey, you know, you guys live on the bleeding edge. You wanted it now. This is the price you pay for it. And that upset a lot of customers, because, like, what was it? Like, a couple months later, the thing dropped, like, in half. And then now we're getting $100 iPhones from AT&T. I mean, that's what I did. But it's just, I feel, you know, sometimes that that Revision A thing is just a very scary thing. But back to the whole, you know, the idea of everything's being disposable and replaceable. I see that more now working in a computer shop, that, you know, that some of these machines, even regular PCs, were a lot better built back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Most
I mean,
certainly.
I still come across old tiny time machines that are going on 8 years, and these things are, despite being so decrepit now, have held up. But I don't expect any of the computers that customers are buying now to last 3 years. They're just so astoundingly poor quality.
It's technically not a PC, but I have a Sun Ultra 5, an UltraSpark machine from, I believe, 1997, maybe 1996, I'm not sure. That machine is made out of, I think it's like plate metal or something. I have no idea. That thing is really heavy, and even the keyboard is made out of metal. It's an insanely very well built construction. I think you could probably bring down houses with that thing. It is really well built.
Or something.
What?
Yeah, that kind of goes back to my first computer, my Dell 210 286. the thing was built like a brick house, man. Like,
yeah.
I remember my first hardware job I ever did on that was trying to install a 3.5-inch floppy drive, and it took a good 2 hours, you know, and in the course, you know, being uneducated and unwilled at the time, you know, it's like, where do I, like, put this? And the thing was so amazingly well built that, I mean, you could throw it in a hurricane and wait a couple hours and wait for it to go, you know, come flying back and fetch it, and the damn thing would still work.
I remember a couple of Dells from high school that were also like this old-fashioned metal housing, metal casing. Okay, they were like beige, but they were so solid and so well-built because they were built to last. Like you said, you bought a computer and you expected it to last for a very long time, because back then computers were new, they were fancy, expensive, and there was a certain expectation that if you spent that much money on a product that it would last for a certain amount of time. But computers have become so commonplace now that you know, manufacturers don't really care about quality anymore, because people need a computer anyway, so they're going to spend that money anyway, whether it's well built or not. They're going to buy that stuff, and most people don't understand anything about it anyway. So they're going to be buying computers, whether they're, you know, priced at €300 and fall apart every 2 seconds, or whether they're priced at €800. You know, they just don't do that anymore. They don't make those really well-built computers anymore, except when you go to the 2000-plus range, like the Mac Pro and everything. So it's they don't have the same
quality control they used to, because now everything is being built in China, Taiwan, and so forth. They've got less strong control over QA on these machines, and so that has kind of, you know, the quality has fallen to the wayside, and that's a hard sell. There's no way you can say that, as you were saying, people see, when you were talking about Macs to people who you're selling it to, that the price always comes down to question. Apple can't just say this is a computer that will last you a long time, because people don't care. They still look at the price. That's always the overpowering factor, isn't it?
Exactly.
Even if you tell people that this will last a long time, the price is still, you know, people are still got to weigh that up.
Yeah. And now I can't even tell them that anymore. I can't even tell them anymore, yo, it's going to last you a longer time. I can't tell them anymore. All I can tell them now, it's going to be easier to manage and it won't break down as often. That's all. That's in software-wise, so I won't have to reinstall your stuff every 6 months. That's, you know, the only thing that I can tell them. That's the only thing. It's okay, it's a little bit more secure because nobody cares about Macs. That's the only thing that I can can tell them, right? So that's all I can't tell them anymore. I mean, it would be a really good sales pitch back then, a couple of years ago, where I could still say, because I hadn't found it out myself yet, that I could still say, look, Max, you know, you spend a little bit more money, but you can resell them for more money and they won't break down, blah, 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 blah. But I can't tell them that anymore with a straight face and without losing friends. So it's kind of, you know, that's sad.
Yeah. And, you know, even though I work at a PC shop, you know, I still recommend Macs or anything, because, I mean, you know, in all honesty, the shop will work on anything. But I find myself, you know, I get these customers that come in, like, you know, every 2 to 3 months because, you know, some Smith fraud variant totally screwed up their install of Windows. And, you know, people are starting to actually think of moving to Macs because they're just fed up with XP not being able to, you know, keep them somewhat safe. And then, of course, they don't want to go to Vista because they've heard things about it. And, you know, it's one thing when, you know, when a product does bad and nobody knows about it, but it's one thing when everybody's talking about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then they hear all these things from, like, PC Magazine or their best friend or some guy that works in the tech department, their job, and they're just all like, you know, hey, we really want to skip out on this Vista thing. And the scary thing is, you know, Microsoft's really trying to herald, you know, Windows 7 as the next big thing. And, I mean, it's good. I'm running it right now, and I'm loving it.
Same here.
But I don't really think of any operating system as having, like, you know, any defined dominion over any other. Just because, you know, they're all double-edged swords. There's always something, you know, that's undesirable or, you know, could be executed a lot better on every one of these pieces of software.
Yeah. What I usually say is that they all suck. It's just that they
exactly.
suck in different. They just suck in different departments. That's
yeah.
exactly.
That's how I see it. And you need to find the one that fits you most and provides you with the least suckage for
exactly.
your
Exactly. And actually, the one that I was actually recommending to my friends years and years ago, and you guys will probably like this a lot, when BOS 3.5 came out.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I was just like demoing this to a couple of my geek friends because, like, guys, you got to check this out. This is the next big thing. And
boy,
immediately,
were you?
Like, well, yeah, I was wrong, and I felt like an ass because of it, but...
sorry. I fell into the same trap. Don't worry about it.
Hey, man, we all did. It's,
yeah.
I remember seeing it on, what was it, on ZDTVs, the screensavers, and I was like, oh, my God, I need this.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of my friends tried it out, and they loved it, and it's a very unfortunate thing that they just could not gain the market share that they needed at the time because of the whole licensing debacle with Microsoft and all that other BS that went along with that. But, you know, I really was hoping that one would really be a contender in the OS wars, as it were, just because I really, really loved it.
Yep, so did I, and I still love it.
But I haven't actually had a chance to try Haiku yet.
We just talked about that in the start of
oh, really?
The podcast. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And have you guys tried it out?
Oh, of course I did.
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
that's almost a silly question asking Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like asking you, are you alive today?
Did I drink coffee today?
No, I've also tried it, but I've never used BIOS before, so it's kind of I don't know what to do with it. is the problem? It's I've got to wait until later on in the stage when they've got their own native browser, and then I can and wireless drivers, and then I can put it to use. I know what I'm doing, and I can start coding.
That's the thing that kind of scares me is, you know, Haiku is actually starting to take off, and I've been wanting to actually really try it out. But the thing that scares me is, like, it hasn't really matured enough for anybody to really do anything really, really serious with it yet. I mean, the same could almost be said about BOS, because I remember when I first got my dirty little hands on a copy of it, there was a real lack of awesome software for it. But at the same time, too, I was happy with just a web browser. So,
positive. Woo.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm really hoping that these guys can really pull it through. I mean, they've been working on it for quite a while. I mean, was it? They've been working on Haiku since like 2002, 2003?
2001, so, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so 8 years.
They've put quite a bit of effort into it, and I have to commend them because, you know, from everything I've read, it's not really based on Linux or anything else, except it's just really a clone of BOS.
It's completely new, top to bottom.
Exactly, yeah. And that's a very commendable engineering feat, because if it were up to me, and I was going to make a new operating system, I'd probably piecemeal it together with Linux and GNU and everything else, because it's already available and it's pretty modifiable by default. So
well, I mean, if these, because the problem with it is with oh well, I mean, it depends on how much you know, the 80/20, how much you slide it. When you integrate with Linux, that you know, you lose something else, and the yet another Linux problem. Because there's been, as we were discussing earlier, things that have tried to re-implement older operating systems' user interface using Linux, and it doesn't work because Linux isn't that operating system, and vice versa. If I was trying to say, for example, RISC OS is the OS I know, and it was around the sort of same era as BIOS, but it was more popular in the UK. If you try to re-implement that, I think it would be. It's not something that I would do. Is do a like-for-like implementation. I would create a compatibility layer so that the old software worked. But ultimately, I would just take the UI principles and write something new, something that tries to be relevant to today. You know, it's to put the web browser at the focus of it, and write a really, really good web browser that uses the UI principles of RISC OS. I mean, RISC OS had some really quite brilliant UI stuff that isn't in any other operating system still, and that others could benefit from. But I just don't think that what they've done with Haiku is immensely commendable. But as Tom was saying, I think you'll hear in the podcast when it's published, that they've got this ever-shrinking window where they need to get something done to stop themselves being cut off at the pass.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, certainly. So, is there anything else we should cover?
I wanted to, I don't know how up on it you are, Mike, but I want to talk about this Google Chrome Frame.
Bring it on.
Oh, yeah, that IE plugin. I heard about that.
I mean, what it is, should explain to anyone who hasn't heard the article yet. Google have created a browser helper object, basically an ActiveX object that you install into Internet Explorer, and it embeds the entire WebKit rendering engine into Internet Explorer, and basically making Internet Explorer super plus awesome. And it's an immensely subversive and brilliant move by Google to basically fix Internet Explorer. Really, they're doing this, I think, for the whole upcoming Wave launch. That Google's email replacement, or so to say, email replacement, Google Wave,
which I still don't understand anything about, but
I think it'll be pretty good when you use it. That's the thing. It's the kind of thing where you shouldn't have to explain it. You should just play with it and then get the idea. Because if you could sit down explaining email forever. In fact, here's an anecdote. when the email was first invented, people were saying, you know, Why do I need to sit and type a message when I've got a phone and I can call the other guy in the office straight away? You can't see the point of these things until, unfortunately, they've reached a certain level of ubiquitousness, and it's be the same with Google Chrome, Google Wave. But basically, because Google Wave uses lots of HTML5 and lots of one of JS features and stuff like that, the Internet Explorer wouldn't have a hope in hell in supporting. Basically, Google have created a very simple way to solve this by embedding WebKit into Internet Explorer, and any web developer can opt into this by adding a HTML tag, a meta tag, to their code, and it will use the rendering engine if it's installed on the computer, and then they can, if they want to, use some JavaScript to prompt people to install Google Chrome Frame if they don't have it. But I mean, this is most amazing that a week before I was saying about we were just discussing the Microsoft have lost their way with the mobile side of things. I was talking about Internet Explorer being so far behind that the only option would be to replace Trident with WebKit, and Google have gone along and actually done that.
Yeah, and it's a good addition because. But I don't think it's really that much about Chrome Frame being some sort of really very serious attempt at undermining IE. It's more about, I think, at least about the whole symbolic meaning of the whole thing.
Standards.
About just Google saying, look, I mean, Microsoft, we're not going to wait for your slow moving behind and just get this over with and look at it here and put Microsoft in a really bad light. And that's basically what it did. And, you know, Microsoft had to respond to this whole thing. And the only thing that they could potentially come up with was some sort of nonsense about security, blah, blah, blah. But it's, I think that's, it really caught Microsoft with the pants down, basically. And Google laughing and the entire internet with any clue laughing and pointing at Microsoft. Like, I think it's pretty cool.
Yes. The only thing I think that people really lose by doing this is some of the memory management that's built into Chrome, which I think is a really, you know, real critical feature of Chrome, is that you know, the tabs have their own memory manager, and I think that's a really neat feature.
I think that makes the reason they're doing this is not so much because they're trying to push Google Chrome or any one browser over another. It's about this whole idea of a web built on standards, and that if everybody has got the standards, then we can all play fairly. And so they're not trying to push Google Chrome itself, because they can do that through other channels anyway. It's really just about trying to bring the web documents up to standards, because that allows for so much more creativity, and Internet Explorer has held the internet back by 5 years. We are astonishingly behind on what is possible with web browsers now because of Internet Explorer dragging its heels and preventing developers from really adopting these things. I mean, oh, good grief, Flash, I would just hope it would go away and die as soon as possible, and even something like this, Google Chrome Frame, is going to help by driving adoption of these standards that mitigate the need for Flash.
Well, on top of that, does Google Chrome Frame, does it actually interfere with IE8's own process isolation thing? Because I believe IE8, I don't even have it installed, but I believe it has...
Sandboxing.
It has the same sandboxing stuff that Chrome has, right?
Well, the thing is, because Google Chrome Frame is... I don't know the exact answer for a certainty. I'd have to test it. But because Google Frame is an ActiveX plugin, surely that would be isolated too, because they are naturally isolated. The problem is, of course, by replacing the web engine with a plugin, there are a number of integration issues of where things hook up, because obviously Internet Explorer assumes that it's speaking to a Trident engine and vice versa. And so the Google Chrome Frame is slightly buggy at the moment, in that printing is not working and the downloads manager isn't working. But those things can all be patched in over time. And it being open source, of course, anyone can contribute, and of course, it being a hotly contested area, and that the developers are seriously interested in this, that those, you know, all of those little polished things will be able to be sorted out. And of course, this is, I forgot, this isn't supposed to be a user feature. This is not something for end users to configure and use and install and know what the heck it is. No, this is purely for to just try and push standards so that the users don't have to care. Once it's on the computer, which Google could even silently install when you actually install Chrome or Google Earth or any of their other software, then any website that opts into it instantly gets a better rendering engine, and the user is none the wiser. That's what's so good about it, because they're not having to push another browser that people have to install. People can just get on and use websites like they normally do.
It's really nifty and innovative. I have to say, it does have the allure of that. But
you know, one thing that's going to actually prove the success of this is how many, you know, users will actually download and use this and actually contribute to the bug reports to make it better. And I guess that's really, I mean, most of the users that are using Internet Explorer are oblivious to the internet around them. And, and with that in mind, you know, they're going to hear that there's this new Google plugin and they'll be like, ah, I've already installed a Google plugin. I'm all done installing plugins. I just want to look at my whatever.
Yeah, but the thing is with web, you can, if the people are willing to install things, if it's if there's some benefit to it, and especially with like Firefox, etc., how successful that's been based purely on people choosing to download it, Google can do much the same as well. In that, you know, you want to use Google Wave and you want to use this latest app, well, you're going to have to install this plugin. It only takes a minute. Click here, wait, done, and you know it's really painless. People will do it.
Google should just make a deal with porn.com. Then it will be everywhere.
Yeah, and then the whole internet will be. updated, yeah. But it's really massively subversive, and it's fantastic in that you know, Microsoft are dragging their heels so much with Internet Explorer, and it's going to be a long time before they come out with the next version of Internet Explorer and they start supporting these standards, and even then it's a question about how well they're going to even support them. And this makes things difficult for Microsoft, because if they do release an excellent version of Internet Explorer, they've still got this problem. They've got so many Chrome users out there and web developers that are using Google Chrome Frame rather than using what's built in with Internet Explorer. Again, it's just all this whole factor of the innovation is happening outside of Microsoft. It's the web is moving faster than Microsoft can, and they're being left behind here.
Yeah, that's always been the case, though. But yeah, who knows? I mean, this could be a really, really neat thing, you know. I'm really hoping for the best, because I'm a big standards guy myself. You know, I really wish the world did operate on standards. And I think Microsoft has really used their position of having Internet Explorer as kind of like another weapon in their OS wars.
More like a boat anchor.
Yeah, because, you know, back in the old days, it's like a lot of web pages were, you know, more or less made to work better with Internet Explorer. And that left, yes, you know, Netscape out of the whole deal, and you know,
I've got an anecdote on that one. At my university, the Free University in Amsterdam, we use this group collaboration thing and core sign up thing called Blackboard, and I think it's used in a lot of other educational institutions as well all around the world. And over the course of the summer, they upgraded to the latest version. I believe it's version 8, if I'm not mistaken. Alternative browsers used to work perfectly fine. I'm hearing a phone. Worked perfectly fine with Blackboard, everything. All the features worked perfectly in Chrome, Firefox, or Internet Explorer, whatever. Now they've got this new version installed, and this new version is only tested to work with Internet Explorer. And if you use anything else but Internet Explorer, it won't work. So I can't upload my assignments. I can't upload my material to Blackboard unless I use Internet Explorer. And that really kind of pissed me off, because I don't have Internet Explorer installed anywhere and I need to hand in my assignments. So a lot of teachers were sympathetic and they don't, you know, just mail them to me and I'll upload them for you. But it's just so counterintuitive and counterproductive to have a tool that used to work perfectly fine and then now there's a new version. I don't even see the fracking difference. And now I suddenly can't upload my stuff anymore. And there are so many people that I know that have Macs that do not have Internet Explorer. There are so many people who I know who use Firefox, and a slightly smaller number of people who use Chrome, all because I installed it for them and anything. But anyway,
yeah.
It's just...
And this all browser-centric view of particular browsers is going away and needs to.
And it's technically not even my university's fault. I mean, they use Blackboard and they you know, have a contract and they upgrade to the latest version. I mean, I don't really blame them. I mean, they're just installing the latest version, and they don't expect, you know, like regressions to occur on something like that. But apparently they do. I went to the website of the company that makes Blackboard, and they have a compatibility chart. I believe my university has to install Surface Spec 3 of version 8 or something. So you can already see the nomenclature is kind of like Microsofty anyway. So they have to install. Yeah, I have to install some sort of Service Pack 3, and then they get some sort of compatibility with at least Firefox. But I don't see anything about WebKit-based browsers.
Yeah,
and
but
it's just,
it's
so backwards.
We've got the problem of the. It's, of course, we expect that with Internet Explorer, but it could, that same problem of browser-specific implementations and checks and things, etc., could happen just with other browsers as websites become, this only works on Firefox or this only works on Chrome, and Google don't want that either. And so it should be about standards that it should work on any browser, and not just targeting one or another, even if that's Internet Explorer or Firefox.
True.
It's very true. You know, me being a guy with an iPhone, I noticed that a lot of web pages just don't work right with the Safari web browser for it. And, you know, it makes me feel kind of sad that I can't, you know, it makes it a real pain in the rear end to, like, you know, try to view certain websites. Like, I mean, even OS News is kind of freaky on the iPhone. Well, it's more or less just about actually, like, the page layout that comes into question. And size of buttons on and elements on other web pages that can really make the whole touch interface just a real headache.
And, oh, yes, tell me about it.
And, you know, I think that's another thing people are going to have to start looking into is, you know, there's going to be a big influx of mobile users that are going to be surfing the web. And, you know, it goes down to that whole standards thing where it's, are we going to develop a standard that makes it work with mobile phones better, or are we going to just develop a standard just for mobile phones? So I think that's another interesting gambit to the whole deal, you know, later on is we're going to start seeing a lot of angry customers with cell phones that can't look at their favorite websites.
Yeah, in this day and age, you can't make an IE-only website now, because if you're operating worldwide, you are throwing away as much as 50% of your users. It's you know, making an IE-only website or IE-only thing or any, you know, any specific browser-only thing is just it's not really practical now. You can do it, but you are severely hampering yourself. And it's good that we've got into that situation now, finally, after, you know, so many years of an absolute and complete stagnation. But now we've got to move that on to the next thing, which is to do this with standards so that we've got complete interoperability and we can use, and we're not dependent upon any one particular vendor, including Flash. I think the next thing that's got to come down is plugins. We've got to get rid of plugins.
Definitely.
Can I drive to stake through? Can I please drive to stake through? I'd be happy.
I would be right there with you.
Yeah.
I would be right there with you.
I think we should start ending this podcast because I've got some translation work to do for tomorrow.
Well, that's all the topics that we had lined up. So I think we'll have to just finish it there.
Okay, good. We need to do some closing things. You usually do that, so go ahead.
Email. You can email us at osnews-crew. In fact, I know we've got a new email address.
You do?
We haven't tested it, but it's just crew@osnews.com. We've just shortened that, although it just redirects to the same thing, which is osnews-crew@osnews.com.
I have no idea. When did that happen?
Oh, Adam just did it like a couple of days ago when I was talking to him on IM or something. I'd forgotten to tell people.
I have no idea when that happened. Did that happen like on the crew list or something? I have no idea.
No, it's not. No one's mailed it. He just set that up. Anyway.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Of course, you can reply to the comment thread on the website when this is published at osnews.com. And Twitter, you can follow us on Twitter, although what we say on Twitter doesn't really have to do anything with OS News. Mm. I'm at twitter.com/KROC.
And I'm at @Tom Howarder.
Mike, do you have anything at all that people can contact you?
Yeah. They can find me and my friend Dave on pcneub.com. That's pcneub.com. You know, folks are just looking for some help. They can also reach me at the All Systems Repair website. If they have any questions, I'm pretty sure no one will. But that's info@allsyst.com.
Okay.
Alrighty then. Thanks very much for joining us actually this week, Mike. That's very good of you. And that's all left to say. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah,
bye.
Bye.